At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
On the program today, a little retail, some taxes, and a crypto camp for your five-year-old. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Reis, in for Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, April 14th. Good to have you along. All right, so we got two economic data points this morning, two data points that paint two pretty different pictures of this economy. On the one hand, we've got the Consumer Sentiment Index from the University of Michigan. It is way up from last month. It actually beat predictions, which suggests that consumers are paying more attention to the strong labor market than they are to inflation. Now, on the other hand, we got retail sales numbers from the Commerce Department, up 0.5% in March, which, not bad. The biggest increases in spending were on food and beverages and, surprise, surprise, at gas stations. Gas sales went up almost 9% between February and last month, which you'd think that kind of inflation would put a damper on consumers' optimism. But as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, today's retail numbers may make the situation at the pump sound worse than it really is.
People talk about gas prices a lot. Hell, my family even has a text group dedicated to alerting each other about where they can find the cheapest gas in Dallas, Texas.
Gasoline prices are something as a society that we all have the right to complain about, just like traffic and the weather.
Michael Knoll teaches economics at Texas Tech University, and he was kind of joking there.
But there's a real element to this. People's gasoline consumption depends on some factors that are hard to change, like the kind of car they drive, how fuel efficient it is, how far away they live from the place that they work or the places that they go.
People who earn less spend a larger percentage of their income on gasoline, so they're affected the most by price spikes. But even those with ample means like to complain about it.
You might even say the psychology is even worse than the actual economic impact.
Ted Rossman is a senior industry analyst at Bankrate.com. He says that's because gas prices are in our faces all the time.
I think it's one of these where we drive around town, we see the billboards, we can't miss it. It's a really obvious form of inflation.
Now, the most recent price spike happened when Russia invaded Ukraine and Brent crude futures almost hit $140 a barrel. Akshay Rao at the University of Minnesota says then the price of gas went up too, and quickly.
When there is a supply shock, then the rational gas station will consider the higher price that they will have to pay to replenish their existing stock. And if they don't raise the price of gasoline, then they will be out of cash when they go to repurchase gasoline.
Okay, sure, but oil prices are down about 20% since then. So why isn't gas much cheaper?
The reason is because now they're valuing their inventory at the price that they paid for it.
That said, gas prices have come down since last month. AAA says they've come down about 6%. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a little quiet on this last day of trading this week. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so I know, I've been talking a lot about data, but it is Thursday, which of course means we've got unemployment claim numbers. 185,000, slightly up from the week before, but we are still near a record low, and it doesn't mean the labor market has fully recovered. As we know, one of the hallmarks of the pandemic has been the so-called she session. Women lost jobs at a much higher rate than men, and many of them left the workforce altogether to stay at home with the kids. And now there's another piece of the COVID economy that's disproportionately impacting women, and that is inflation. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports.
You've probably heard of the pink tax, when companies price comparable items like deodorant and razors higher for women than men. Why?
I mean, one very simple reason is simply because companies can get away with it.
Vicky Morwitz is a marketing professor at Columbia Business School. She says some of this is discrimination, but there are logical reasons too. For instance, women's haircuts can take more time. There are also strategic reasons. Companies might, say, use a higher quality fabric for a blouse because it allows them to mark up the price more.
Women may just value those things and be willing to pay more to obtain those features.
Retailers use the same tactics when they raise prices. Krish Thiagarajan is president of the retail analytics company Dataweave. He looked at 6 months of pricing data across 1 million products, mostly apparel and shoes.
A higher proportion of product in the women's side saw a higher increase. So women seems to be kind of gyrating more than men's.
The data show prices for women's clothing and shoes increased about 15%. 4% more than for men's. The gap may not sound like much, but women already only make 83 cents for every dollar a man makes. Women of color make even less. It also has a psychological effect. Francesco DeCunto, a professor of finance at Boston College, says higher prices for jeans may make women more sensitive to inflation in general, especially since women do most of the household shopping.
They actually find inflation much more visible, and therefore they think more about inflation. They actually expect systematically that inflation will be higher.
This matters a lot because expectations about inflation change how people look at their personal economies, including whether their wages are worth working for.
And so this type of effect could be important and, unfortunately, again, another negative potential effect for the case of women because it would reduce their labor force participation.
DeCunto says a she-session and she-flation are colliding and that this could further slow down women's return to the workforce. Also, it's putting a lot more stress on women who already feel stretched thin after more than 2 years of pandemic parenting. Stacey Long is 42 and lives in Chatham, Massachusetts. The restaurant she served at laid her off at the beginning of the pandemic. She was also pregnant with her second child, which made her extra worried about the virus. And she and her boyfriend, who works as a builder and fisherman, couldn't find childcare for her toddler.
And then if you find any, the prices are so high, and then that's your entire paycheck. So then almost like, what is the point?
Meanwhile, rising food prices means she switched to generic brand formula for her baby, and she spends more time couponing and getting creative in the kitchen.
I'm trying to make really awesome meals, but yet, what can you do with a family pack of chicken legs? You can only stretch that so far to make something, you know?
Long serves her family at home, but she really misses serving at the restaurant. She's an extrovert and likes interacting with customers. She's hoping to get back to work 2 nights a week this summer.
Well, I definitely need my sanity. And with 2 little boys, I'm going to work somehow. I'm going to figure it out.
But with soaring prices and childcare costs, work might contribute more to her sanity than her family's budget. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
A little reminder, the tax deadline is April 18th. Also a reminder for myself, because I still haven't done mine. Anyway, the IRS has already processed 63 million refunds as of April 1st. And yeah, there is still a backlog of returns from last year's tax filing season. In many ways, filing for taxes can feel like a rite of adulthood. And if you're a college student in particular, you can actually be eligible for thousands of dollars in tax credits. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes explains.
On the campus of the Pratt Institute, an art and design school in Brooklyn, taxes were not top of mind for freshman Danny Botcher and Mara Nicolae.
Do you know when the deadline is?
No, I don't know anything. I'm like...
The 14th? No, that's not the... I don't know.
For the record, this year it's Monday, April 18th. Last year, Nikolai had a job as a barista, filed and got a refund.
I think I got like $50, so that was pretty nice. I wasn't expecting anything.
Lots of people don't expect anything, so many don't file. Those people are still due $1.5 billion from tax year 2018. Anthony Burke is a public affairs specialist with the IRS.
That money goes back to the Treasury Department if people don't file and claim those refunds.
This year, students could be due additional money if no one's claiming them as a dependent.
And about half of all students are independent. So they're not actually what we think of as the 19-year-olds who are going off to school.
Kim Rubin is a fellow in the Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute. She says those independent students can get $1,400 in stimulus payments from the American Rescue Plan.
They could claim that even if this is the first year that they're independent than their parents.
College students are also eligible for other credits, says Matthew Gardner, a senior fellow at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy.
They're sensibly designed to make college more attainable, to make it so that students don't have to live in poverty just to pay for their college expenses.
On the other hand, students may owe taxes. If they used government Pell Grants for things like transportation or housing, that's considered taxable income. In New York, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up,
working towards something more than a paycheck.
I feel that. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones lost 113 points, 0.3%, to close at 34,451. The Nasdaq dropped 292 points, 0.2%, to land at 13,351. And the S&P 500 fell 54 points, 0.2%, to end at 4,392. We just heard from Stephanie about taxes and tax prep stocks. H&R Block slipped 0.1%. Paychex Inc. lost nearly 0.9%. Sure, you've heard by now that Elon Musk is looking to buy Twitter at a $43 billion valuation. Twitter was down more than 1.5% today, and Tesla was down more than 3.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose 2.82%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look. Payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. Cryptocurrencies, probably the most well-known as Bitcoin, feel pretty inescapable these days. The industry has infiltrated Super Bowl ads, the stadium where the Lakers play. We've got politicians getting paid in crypto. And now it is coming for your children. No, but seriously, in a piece recently for Vox, senior reporter Rebecca Jennings wrote about a growing industry of camps, startups, video content, all aimed at educating the next generation of crypto enthusiasts. Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, crypto for kids. Can you tell me a little bit more about what we're seeing?
So what we're seeing a lot of over the past couple of years, especially during the pandemic, is there's this like network of summer camps, startups directed towards kids and families, and video and book content just directed at teaching kids about crypto and Web3 and blockchain and all these really complicated concepts.
Yeah. You wrote in your article, there's this one camp, I think it was in California, where they gave every kid a laptop, a drone, a robot, a VR headset, and a phone with a crypto wallet. And they get to keep
it. Yeah, wild. Yeah. I was shocked when she told me that. I was like, wait.
Yeah. So what's the pitch that these companies make to parents and investors?
So I think for Crypto Kids Camp, which it targets kids from, you know, historically underrepresented people in tech fields. So it's a lot of kids that live in poorer neighborhoods. And so what they're trying to do is decrease the wealth gap. The really volatile market has made a lot of people, you know, a lot of people very rich. So I think they're seeing that as an opportunity of like, hey, can we get like people who don't really have a shot at working for, you know, a traditional banking or tech background to learn some of those skills?
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I feel like there is a lot of crypto FOMO that's happening right now. Like, if you're not doing this right now, then you are missing out. Yeah. So I can see how it makes sense why parents would want to give their kids a step up. But is there evidence that these programs actually prepare kids for the quote unquote future?
I mean, they haven't been around long enough to really say for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure what they're teaching kids is not something they're probably getting in public schools or in private schools or wherever they go. But I think it's sort of like an attempt at making up for the fact that personal finance education in most school systems in the U.S. is just extremely poor.
Yes.
Kids are not taught how to deal with money in any real way. And so I think this is sort of billed as a counterweight to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely wish I'd gotten some of that education in school.
Yeah.
But, you know, cryptocurrencies, it does feel different, right? Like it's unpredictable, it's fast moving. What are some of the critiques you've heard about these initiatives?
Yeah, I mean, I talked to one psychologist who studies finances and families. Her concern is that, you know, this kind of way of looking at money and weighing of dealing with money rewards very high risk investments, which not necessarily the thing that you want to be teaching a kid or a teenager who she had one analogy where she was like, you know, you can tell a kid that, you know, only one person out of 1,000 is going to really hit the jackpot. But a teenager is going to be like, oh, I'm going to be the one to hit the jackpot.
Of course.
Like, that'll be me.
Yeah.
And so her advice was to, you know, give kids like, you know, a couple bucks, like $5. Tell them to go ahead, go invest and like see what happens because they're probably going to lose it. And like imagine if that were $1,000, you know, like that would have hurt even worse.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So some of these programs you wrote about, they are aimed at really young kids, like as young as 5 years old. But you write that a lot of teenagers, they have these crypto stars in their eyes and are already investing on platforms like Robinhood. What do you see as the possible societal implications of teenagers engaging in these potentially risky financial habits?
I mean, I think the really big problem is that the stories that get told are the successes. And so we never see, you know, the full picture on how many people have lost everything. It's a perspective that we really need right now that we're not getting enough of.
Rebecca Jennings is a senior correspondent at Vox, writing about crypto for kids. Rebecca, it was great talking to you.
Thank you so much.
$5.4 million. That is how many new business applications were filed last year, according to the Census Bureau. That beats the previous record we saw in 2020, by the way, of $4.4 million. Even though many small businesses were hit incredibly hard during the pandemic, it feels safe to say that we are now in the midst of an entrepreneurship boom. And that includes Black-owned businesses. For this next story, we go to Tennessee, where a pop-up market is giving Black-owned businesses a physical space to sell and ideally thrive. Nashville Public Radio's Ambrielle Crutchfield has more.
Y'all is here. We're about to kick off. We already got customers in the building, so...
This is Carlos Parti. He's the owner of the brand Cashville. He sells T-shirts and hats. Plus, he's one of the founders of the Nashville Black Market. The origin story of the floating monthly pop-up market is very simple. The cost of a physical store was too high for Parti and his business partner.
So what we did was we started the market, pretty much. We started off with 15 vendors, and it's grown ever since then.
That was back in 2018. Now he says they've hosted almost a dozen events around the city with close to 500 vendors who brought in a total of $500,000. At a market early this year, the Magic Trap owner, Kari Jones, showed customers her incense, oils, and crystals.
Yeah, this is the only jade I have right here.
Back in 2020, Jones couldn't find a local Black-owned business that sold crystals, so she decided to start her own.
I'm very adamant about circulating the Black dollar to support our community and the people that live in the community with us.
For now, she's working full-time in customer service and running her business on the side. Eventually, she'd like Magic Trap to be her main focus. Vendors pay around $150 to have a space at the market. And at a two-day event, Jones says she made almost $3,000.
Yeah, it's definitely worth it.
Nationwide, there's been a significant increase in new online Black-owned micro-businesses. Most have fewer than 10 employees. The Brookings Institution reports they accounted for 26% of all new online micro-businesses, up from 15% before the pandemic. Parti wants to find a way to build his business on the momentum locally.
So what we're trying to do is trying to pinpoint those things to where it's like, okay, we have an event once a month, but if we have this one event once a month and it's impactful, how can we do two events?
So far, he says he and the other Black Market business owner have made $88,000 since 2018. Now the market's co-founders are aiming to get a permanent space where Black business owners can sell their products.
Be able to show, hey, you can make money. But also, we are trying to figure out ways to create this retail space to where that we can showcase our vendors.
Parti says creating generational wealth is a long-term goal. But Parti and his business partner say they need more capital and guidance. That last piece is something the Greater Nashville Black Chamber of Commerce already offers its members. Carolyn Waller is the president of the organization. She says for the chamber to endorse a business, it needs to prove it can bring in consistent sales over several years.
That they're able to produce based on longevity with their businesses and their operational.
Brookings reports that in 2019, Black-owned businesses made up less than 3% of all businesses nationwide. In Nashville, I'm Ambrielle Crutchfield for Marketplace.
Started the show with retail sales, talked about gas, food, beverages. Another category we're going to get into today, hobby stores. They saw a 3.3% increase in March. And that brings us to another installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Colin Garrity. I make pottery tools out of wood, mostly. Garrity Tools is a small company based in St. Louis, Missouri. There are five full-time people on the team, and we make wooden pottery tools. It is just a bunch of random shapes and designs that we come up with and then test out and make for potters shaping clay on a wheel. The company's been working really hard to just keep up with demand. You wouldn't really expect it, but there's a huge world of potters out there who are excited to buy tools, excited to be a part of what we're creating. And so we're just working hard to ship orders relatively timely. Our company has been operating for about 4 years with me as the owner. And as of last week, we are now a worker-owned co-op. Every employee has a path to ownership. There are some requirements 2 years of working there, you fill out an application and everyone votes on you in the same way that we vote about everything else. Everyone from the person running the office to the person sweeping the floors knows that they are working towards something more than a paycheck, and it's pretty incredible. I think over the past 2 years, a lot of people have put a lot of thought into how work controls their lives and what makes them happy and how they usually have to choose between the two. And I think that this is a great way to create an example of how a business can also support its employees and not just value them based on how productive they are. But it's a way for people to really benefit from their hard work and to be able to decide for themselves what their work wants to look like. A lot of people love building a business and don't love running a business. And so, you know, they sell it to VC firms or to some other serial entrepreneur. And this is a great way for people to do what they care about, create designs, create companies, and then have them continue on in a way that's really great for the communities they are operating within. I'm pretty lucky to love what I do and the people I work with. And I think that it's important to recognize that that's something that sometimes takes maybe some sacrifice and some hard work to maintain and to build for as many people as possible.
That's Colin Garrity out of St. Louis, Missouri. The series, by the way, only works because of your submissions, which you can do at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Final note on the way out today. Andy talked about inflation at the top of the show and how we feel or don't feel the pain at the pump. Meanwhile, Amazon said that for the first time in company history, it will charge sellers a 5% fuel and inflation surcharge. And it's not just Amazon, right? Uber and Lyft recently started tacking on fuel surcharges, and airlines are also hiking up their prices, which definitely noticed the other day trying to book a flight home. All right, no time for economic context today. You're going to have to find your own. I'm sorry. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. And I'm Rima Jerez. I'll catch y'all tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.